I'm Angela, and I would like to start off by thanking the organizers for this conference. I'm very excited to present this result that we've been working on. It's a very new result that I've been working on with Joel and Stephen. And hopefully you guys will like it because I find it very exciting. Okay, so when I presented this result at my university in Sydney, someone after the talk said to me that if you had told me what the result was at the beginning of the talk, then I would have listened to your talk. So I took on board the criticism, and just in case, here's the main result. Okay, so the main result is that we bound the minimum number of classical bits required to specify the state of any system in any model that reproduces stabilizer statistics. And that bound is n over 2 n minus 1, where n is the number of qubits in your model. Okay, so I'm going to unpack this throughout the talk. So I haven't told you yet what the stabilizer subtheory is, the n-qubit stabilizer subtheory. And I haven't told you what I mean by modeling the statistics of a particular subtheory. So that's what I'm going to start by telling you. Okay, so here's a quick overview. These are the questions I'm going to try and answer throughout the talk. Why should you care about this result? How it is particularly related to contextuality, and this is going to be the most exciting main part of the talk. I'm going to try and give you an explicit link between contextuality and simulatability, something that's a bit more precise than the usual conjectures that we have so far. Then I'm going to very, very briefly present to you the results and how we did it. And the reason this is very brief is because I've taken out all the proofs. And they're basically the results of all the theorems. And I could, as I said, I stated the result in one line. I've taken all the proofs out. So I'm going to focus on the implications of this result, particularly between establishing this link between contextuality and simulatability. Okay, so what does it mean to simulate quantum statistics? Okay, so imagine a prepare and measure scenario where you have a black box with some settings on it, and you can change the settings to control which preparation procedure you carry out. Now, depending on your preparation setting, this box spits out an object that goes into a second box, which is your measurement device. And this measurement device also has some knob settings on it, and you can change it to decide which is the observable that you would like to measure. So the measurement device takes in the object that the preparation box spits out, and it gives out an outcome, k. Now, this is just how I can model any experiment. And this is the data table for the experiment. So the data table consists of the preparation procedures and the measurement procedures with labeled by their outcomes. So this is measurement 1 with outcome 1, measurement 1 with outcome 2, so on and so forth. And then the experimentalist records the data in this data table, and what we're interested in is this quantity, which is the probability of getting outcome k, given that the knob setting on the preparation box was p and the knob setting on the measurement box was m. And this is what I'm going to call the outcome statistics of a particular measurement. So this is the operational statistics. And what we now want is to come up with a model that is going to reproduce the outcome statistics of a particular measurement. So when I talk about models of a particular quantum subtheory, what I mean is that you have certain experiments which can be described quantum mechanically, and it forms a closed quantum subtheory. And it gives you a data table. Now, this data table is filled with Born rule probabilities. But because it's a subtheory, it's a subset of the whole data table created by quantum mechanics. And what we want is we want to try and model this data table, which consists of Born rule probabilities, using the most efficient model possible. Now, quantum mechanics itself is such a model for a data table, and what we're going to now consider is a framework in which we can analyze all possible models that reproduces a data table, and then try and find the most efficient one, and see how contextuality affects the efficiency of the most efficient possible data, model for a given data table. Okay, so why should you care about simulation of quantum systems? Now, I feel like pretty much everyone I know in quantum information falls into one of these two areas, and I find myself here, although I started off here. But let me tell you why you should care. So for quantum computation, if you're interested in quantum computation and you want to build this quantum computer, say you spend a lot of money building this really, really nice quantum computer, but that quantum computer only has gates and it can only have only has measurements and it can only prepare states, which produces a subtheory of quantum mechanics, which is completely efficiently classically simulatable. By which I mean, even if you have someone with this huge, hugely expensive quantum computer and someone else who has access to a classical computer, this person who has access to a classical computer can efficiently simulate the outcome statistics, and hence this person who has the quantum computer has no net advantage. So it would be completely useless and it would be a complete waste of time. So you want to know what are the sets of operations or what are the sets of preparations and measurements that one requires to get an advantage over classical computation. Okay, so that's a very kind of practical application. And the next one is if you care about foundations. Now, the reason you should care about simulation of quantum systems if you care about foundations is because one of the main questions that we deal with in foundations of quantum mechanics is this distinction between what is classical and non-classical. And I bet if I ask every one of you in this room what you define as a classical theory and what you define as a non-classical theory, each and every one of you will give me a slightly different definition. So then can we find some common ground? Well, there's one notion of non-classicality which I think everyone in this room can objectively agree on, which is if I take a data table produced by quantum mechanics that cannot be efficiently simulated by a classical model, then that means that that data table, which can be produced efficiently by the quantum system itself, is somehow non-classical. So that is a very objective distinguishing point between a classical theory and a non-classical theory, which I think, regardless of what your taste is, you can agree on. Okay, so let me give you some context on where this research, what this research program is about. So I'm going to be talking about the stabilizer subtheory. Now, why do we have so much work going into the stabilizer subtheory? And that's because this is a very, very important subtheory for fault-tolerant quantum computation. Most of the circuits that we can build in the labs are actually Clifford circuits, which are part of the stabilizer subtheory. But the stabilizer subtheory itself is efficiently simulatable classically. The way you take it from an efficiently simulatable subtheory to universal quantum computation is by injecting these states, which are called magic states, which add the magic into classical computation to take you to quantum. And there's this nice result for QDITs, where magic states, which are found to be the resource states, are exactly the states that display contextuality. So for the QDIT stabilizer, for the QDIT subtheory, all of the states that can be simulatable, the stabilizer states, don't allow a proof of contextuality. But as soon as you go outside of that set to find magic states that that you can inject into the theory as a resource to raise you to quantum computation, you find that those are the states that display contextuality. And then the other thing is the Wigner function for qubit stabilizer states is completely positive. And as Steve mentioned in his talk, that if you have a positive Wigner function, that gives you a natural way of sampling from that distribution because it's positive, and that gives you a way of simulating the statistics. So the non-negative Wigner function for qubit stabilizers gives an efficient classical sampling algorithm to reproduce the statistics. So this relationship between contextuality and simulatability, efficient simulatability, is pretty nice in the QDIT scenario. However, this breaks down to some extent when it comes to qubits. And the reason for this is state-independent contextuality. So state-independent contextuality appears in qubit stabilizers. And qubit stabilizers, as all stabilizers, is efficiently simulatable. However, they do display some contextuality. So now, if you ask me this question, is contextuality a computational resource? I cannot give you a clear answer like I could in the QDIT picture, because for the qubit stabilizers, you have contextuality, but it does not give you anything more than classical computation. However, what contextuality makes pretty hard to do in the qubit case is it obstructs any kind of classical sampling algorithm. So for the qubit case, the Wigner function, even for qubit stabilizers, goes negative. And this is partly to do with contextuality. And because of this, you can't sample from the Wigner function because you have negative probabilities. And therefore, you don't have a natural sampling algorithm like you did in the QDIT case. OK, so here's what we show. So what we show is the explicit effect of state-independent contextuality on the size of the state space of a model. So we are trying to kind of develop a measure, because I don't want to have this notion of contextuality and simulatability. I want to have this notion of measure of contextuality and how easy or hard it is to simulate something, because then you can make quantitative connections between the two. So this is what we try and do. We try and show the explicit effect of state-independent contextuality by defining a measure on it, on bounding the minimum size of the state space required for any model that reproduces the data table. When we establish that at the end, we see that the reason the qubit stabilizers are efficiently simulatable, despite the contextuality, is because the number of states actually grows pretty nicely. And it'll become clear what I mean later on in the talk, but contextuality does make things harder, even in the qubit stabilizer case, but because there's such few qubit stabilizer states, it grows nicely with n, we can still come up with an efficient classical simulation. And what we finally show is that a sampling algorithm cannot do much better than the Gottesman-Neil algorithm. So I think there was a question earlier in Steve's talk where someone asked that, you know, you can have Gottesman-Neil can be thought of as an ontological model. And yes, it can be thought of as an ontological model. But the reason we are looking for epistemic models is because we would like to represent multiple quantum states by the same ontic state. And hopefully, that will make our simulation more efficient. This is what happens in the QDIT Wigner function. The QDIT Wigner function is more efficient in state space than the Gottesman-Neil algorithm, because there is, for one lambda, it can represent multiple quantum states. Okay, so what is the n-qubit stabilizer subtheory? The n-qubit stabilizer subtheory consists of measurements, which are n-qubit Pauli observables. So the knob settings on your measurement device now are just the Pauli observables. Preparations are eigenstates of n-qubit Pauli operators, which you can think of as the preparation procedures that can be carried out by actually measuring these observables. So you always have an eigenstate of one of these observables. And the transformations are represented as Clifford unitaries in quantum mechanics. By the way, feel free to ask me questions at any point, because this is not yet.
So when you say n cubic Pauli observable measurements, do you mean a product of Pauli's, or do you mean, you know, an arbitrary tensor product of Pauli?
Arbitrary tensor product of Pauli's, yep. So they can be non-local observables. So they, yeah. Okay, so the framework that I was talking about, which allows us to explore all models that simulates a particular data table, is the ontological models framework. This framework gives us a nice platform for analyzing, you know, weak simulation sampling algorithms, as well as algorithms which just compute the Born rule. And it also allows us to analyze quantum mechanics itself. So you can think of ontological models, any computational algorithm within this framework. So it provides a very nice framework in which you can evaluate the efficiency of a particular model in reproducing a given data table. Okay, so the main ingredients of an ontological model is the state space. So the state space is, so an element of the state space is the description of your quantum system. So it is the state of your quantum system in the particular model. Then for every preparation procedure, you define a function, mu p, which is basically the probability of preparing the state lambda given you've carried out preparation procedure p. So think of that preparation box again. If you turn the knob setting to p, what is the probability that the particle inside is going to end up in the state that you describe as lambda in your particular model? And then the next set of functions that you define are the response functions. And you define a response function for every measurement procedure and every outcome. So this is the response function for measurement procedure M with outcome K. And what this tells you is the probability of getting outcome K, given that you carried out measurement procedure M and your state of your system is in lambda. And these are the primitive elements of this framework. And when you put them together, all you require to reproduce quantum statistics is that they have to give you the Born rule. So do you remember when I put up the outcome statistics, the data table, I said the most important thing is the outcome statistics, which is the probability of getting a particular outcome given a measurement procedure and a preparation procedure. And this is given by the Born rule in quantum mechanics. So if you want to reproduce quantum statistics, then you require that these two probabilities multiplied together gives you the Born rule. Okay. So a physical picture for it, again, is you have your preparation box P. This with probability mu P prepares your state lambda. So this is your particle is spit out in the state lambda. This lambda goes into M. And M with some probability outputs K and also outputs the state, which can now be in a different state. So it can be in a different lambda. OK, so this is the first constraint on all models that reproduces quantum mechanics. And I'm not making any assumptions here. This is the most bare bones structure of ontological models. But this restriction holds for any model that reproduces quantum mechanics. And that is that if two states are perfectly distinguishable, by which I mean you can do a single-shot distinguishability test between the two preparation procedures. So every time you can tell them apart, even with one copy of the system, then those two preparation procedures must have disjoint support on your ontological space. And this might be obvious to some of you, but here's a picture. OK, so this is what I mean. So if you have if this is not the case, so imagine you have preparation procedure P1 and P2. And these two are represented by rho and sigma, where rho, the trace of rho and sigma is zero, which means they're orthogonal states, which means you can distinguish them perfectly at every time. Then if these two things had an overlap, that means there would be a state lambda, which would be in the support of both of these. Then you would get this. So then with some probability, both preparation procedures would produce the state lambda. And lambda is the only input that goes into this measurement device M. And with some probability, you're going to get K. So in this scenario, there's no way of distinguish between P1 and P2. And we know that in quantum mechanics, orthogonal states are perfectly distinguishable. And hence, the support of two preparation procedures that correspond to two orthogonal states in quantum mechanics must have disjoint support in your particular model, regardless of what model it is. Okay. The next requirement from a good simulation is that you want to be able to describe the state of your system even after a measurement. What I mean by that is you should allow for sequential measurements, because sequential measurements are, you know, where you see the interesting quantum phenomena like contextuality and stuff. So you want your model to be able to reproduce those statistics. So here is the picture of the sequential measurement where preparation procedure P produces lambda. Lambda goes into measurement device M1. There is some outcome K. And then with this probability, you get a state lambda dashed. And lambda dashed now goes into a second measurement device, and you get some outcome. And in order for your model to not contradict quantum mechanics, you require that if this measurement maps rho to rho dash, then any lambda which is in the support of a preparation procedure that prepares rho must be mapped to a state which is in the support of the preparation procedure describing rho dash. Okay, so these are the only two requirements of any ontological model or any model that reproduces quantum statistics. And I have to say at this point that these requirements are for any model which even possibilistically produces quantum statistics as well, by which I mean that now we don't care about the probabilities, but we actually only care about not contradicting quantum mechanics. That any given experiment, I cannot, if I give you an answer, I cannot do a quantum experiment that will contradict the answer given by your model. So this applies to both probabilistic and possibilistic models. So two requirements: experimentally distinguishable states must have disjoint support, and the state of a system can be described even after a measurement like this. Now, this criteria is what we're going to be using in all our subsequent proofs. So this is what, if someone doesn't understand this, let me know, because this is the crucial point of the talk. Okay. All right, so let me now go on to PBR. So PBR, the PUC Barrett-Rudolph paper, made some claims about the reality of the wave function. And then there was a lot of controversy about it, about what assumptions are natural or not natural. But what I want to do over here is use those same states without any kind of assumption about reality or an ontological model or how natural or unnatural an assumption is. And I just want to say what the mathematical theorem says. So here you have your four PBR states. So I've written it in this notation, which is the stabilizer notation, which means that this state is the eigenstate of all three of these observables, this state, eigenstate of all of these, and so on and so forth. So these are your PBR states. And now the theorem says that the four-partite support, so the support of all of these, the intersection of the support of all four of these states, must be an empty set. And what is the proof of this? Well, okay, so I do a YY measurement, and I get outcome 1. So once I do a YY measurement and get outcome one, these states are mapped to these corresponding quantum states. Now notice that in this case, these two states are orthogonal, because you can see this lies in the minus ZZ eigenspace, this lies in the plus ZZ eigenspace, or you can check with this as well. So rho 1 dashed and rho 2 dashed are orthogonal, which means that their overlap must be empty, because I said that orthogonal states must have disjoint support on your ontic state, and therefore the support of all four of these states is an empty set. And because we have this requirement that lambda needs to map to some lambda dash, if this is an empty set, then the pre-image of this must be empty as well. And this gives you your theorem, which is there is no lambda which is in the support of all four of these states, which are your PBR states. Okay? And that is PBR without preparation independence assumption or any other kind of assumption. Okay, so what does this mean for simulation? Turns out PBR has a significant contribution or significant insight into simulation as well. Okay, so now if I get YY equals minus one, so one thing you could say is that we're going to disallow YY equals plus one, and we're going to say that every time I do an experiment on these states, I get YY equals minus one. And then you see that these two states become orthogonal. So here you can see they're orthogonal because this is the plus one eigenspace of XZ, and this is the minus one eigenspace of XZ. So these two are now orthogonal, which means their support must be disjoint, which means the support of all four of these are disjoint, and similarly, the pre-image must be disjoint as well. So regardless of what outcome you get from this particular measurement, and when you do YY, there's only two outcomes possible, one or minus one, and in both cases, you get a set which has at least one pair of orthogonal states, which means that their intersection of the supports must be the empty set, and therefore the intersection of the supports of the PBR states is empty. Okay, so how is this related to contextuality? Well, PBR is related to contextuality in a very obvious way. So this is the Perez-Merman square, which I'm sure everyone knows and loves by now. And what PBR is just the simultaneous eigenstates of the rows and the columns. So the first state is the simultaneous eigenstate of the first row. Second one is the simultaneous eigenstate of the second row. And this is the eigenstate of the first column. And this is the eigenstate of the second column. And then the measurement that we did to give us our contradiction was this measurement here, YY. And what happened is that when we got a plus one outcome, then we got a contradiction with this particular context, because then these two states are mapped to orthogonal states. And when we get a minus one, then we get a contradiction between row three and row four, because row three and row four are mapped to a set of orthogonal states. So the PBR measurement can just be thought of an adaptive measurement where you do YY, and then based on the outcome, you choose to measure either XX and ZZ or ZX and XZ. And because there is no possible value assignment that is consistent with all of the correlations of these observables, you get the contradiction that you see in PBR and then what you see, what you saw in the previous slide. Okay, so okay, but this result does not just apply to the four PBR states, but it applies to any set of states which is unitarily equivalent, or I should say Clifford equivalent, to the PBR states. By this, I mean if there exists any Clifford which, when applied to all the states in a given set, gives you another set. So two sets are Clifford equivalent if you can get from one set to the other by conjugating all of those states with just one Clifford. Okay? And you can see that if it works for the PBR states, it must work for any Clifford equivalent set of states to PBR, because whatever your contradicting measurement was, you just conjugate that by the Clifford that takes you from set one to set two, and you get the same contradiction on the other side, because obviously the orthogonal, the overlaps are preserved under unitary transformations, and so states that were orthogonal remain orthogonal even after the Clifford conjugation. So, and this can actually be thought of taking the Perez Merman square and then just doing unitary transformations on the Perez Merman square, and that gives you many other Perez Merman squares with just different observables, and like the PBR states with the rows and columns. Similarly, the Perez the unitarily rotated Perez Merman squares, rows and columns, will give you these sets in this class, this equivalence class of PBR. Okay, so then we actually found other sets that are PBR-like, and when I mean they're PBR-like, the proof that I just showed you for PBR, you can get exactly that same proof for all of these sets. Because they apply to the set, it obviously applies to all the equivalence classes of these sets. And all of these proofs can be seen as proofs of contextuality. So anytime we can construct a proof of contextuality with eigenstates of Pauli observables, we see that their eigenstates can have no overlap. So the intersection of the support of the eigenstates has to be empty. Oh, sorry. This means this is the stabilizer group generated by these two elements, and so this is one stabilizer state, second stabilizer state, third, fourth, and this is the equivalence class of this set of stabilizer states. Okay, so then this is our theorem for n equals 2, which is that the largest possible set of states that can be described by the same ontic state is 5, which means any set of states larger than 5 cannot have any common support. And the way we, I'm not going to show you the proof because the proof is boring, but the idea behind the proof is that one cannot construct any set of states larger than 5 such that the subset of 4 within it is not PBR-like. So so the sets of 4 states that I showed you earlier that does not allow a common overlap, they form a subset of any state, any set of states, which has a cardinality larger than 5.
So you're saying states within the stabilizer theory?
Yes. Yeah. So basically, you take a set of 6 stabilizer states, for example, and there will exist a subset of 4, which is PBR-like. Yes.
Are you sure? Sorry? Are you sure an example of a set of 5 states?
I don't have them on the slide, but I can show you later on. Yeah. Okay, so I generalize this result to n qubits, where I show that this result actually scales with the number of qubits in this way. So for n qubit stabilizer subtheory, by which I mean now we've expanded to n qubit Pauli observables, the cardinality of the largest set of states that allow an overlap or allow a common description in your model grows as 3 to the power n minus 2 times 5. Okay, I'm not going to have time to write this up on the board. Maybe I can come back to it. Okay. So what does this mean about simulation? Well, so now if I say that the support of any set of n qubit states, any n qubit stabilizer states, which is larger than 5, has an empty support, that means the largest number of n qubit stabilizer states that can be described by a single element in your sample space is this number, 3n minus 2 times 5. And so now it's very easy to bound the minimum size of state space required to reproduce your statistics, because you just take the largest number of you take the number of total stabilizer states, and you divide that by the largest number of states that your lambda can be in the support of, and that gives you the minimum number of lambdas required to simulate stabilizer statistics. Okay, so the minimum lambda required turns out to be this number. And what this means is that the minimum number of classical bits of information required to encode the state of a system in any model that reproduces qubit stabilizer statistics grows as this. And I need to emphasize at this point that we have made no assumptions about these kind of models. They can be contextual, non-contextual. They can include weak sampling algorithms, strong sampling algorithms, anything, even possibilistic models of the qubit stabilizer statistics. Any model that does not contradict qubit stabilizer statistics requires a minimum of these many classical bits to encode the state of the system. And the Gottesman-Neil algorithm actually has a very similar form in the number of classical bits required to encode the state of your system. So you can see that, you know, this hope of coming up with a weak sampling algorithm that does better than Gottesman-Neil is somehow not going to play out, because these have very, very similar scalings. Okay, so this answers two of the questions that have been posed in the literature before. And the first question is, what is the effect of the presence of contextuality in the qubit subtheory on simulation, the qubit stabilizer subtheory? And the explicit effect is that no model can do much better than Gottesman-Neil. Now, Gottesman-Neil, thought of in the ontological models framework, is where there's a one-to-one correspondence between your quantum state and its description in your model. So you represent each quantum state by its stabilizers and destabilizers, and so each quantum state has a unique description in your ontological model. And the hope was that maybe by coming up with a weak sampling algorithm, you could have a state that could be in the support of multiple quantum states and give you a more efficient description. But because of state-independent contextuality, which is present in the qubit stabilizer subtheory, you actually get the same asymptotic scaling as Gottesman-Neil. So you can see that it does make your life harder, but the only reason it is efficiently simulatable is because the number of quantum stabilizer states itself is very small. So even if you have a one-to-one correspondence between your quantum state and your ontological model, you're going to get the same scaling as if you tried to be clever and come up with same asymptotic scaling if you tried to use a sampling algorithm. Okay, how is this different from the QDITS subtheory? Well, the QDITS subtheory does not have any contextuality in it. And because of this, you can actually get a better scaling than Gottesman-Neil, because Gottesman-Neil gives you an asymptotic scaling of n squared. And with the Wigner function, which gives you the sampling algorithm, you actually get a linear scaling in the number of qubits for number of qudits for the qudit stabilizer subtheory. So the difference between these scalings is the presence of contextuality in qubit stabilizer subtheory. Okay, so what now? So now what we want to do is, we have only spoken about the qubit stabilizer subtheory until now, but nothing about the approach that we used was restricted to the stabilizer subtheory. So one question is, can we use this approach to say similar things about other quantum subtheories? And more importantly, can we develop a precise measure of contextuality that has a direct link to simulatability? Okay, so before I talk about this measure of contextuality, I want to define what I mean about contextuality. And I know I'm like three quarters of the way through the talk, and only now am I defining contextuality. But yeah, okay, so what I define by, what I mean by contextuality is that I define something called a non-contextual value assignment, which is a function that maps every observable to an eigenvalue of the Hermitian operator that represents that observable in quantum theory. And we want the value assignment to respect this relationship, where the value assignment of a product of two observables must be equal to the product of the value assignments of the two observables if those two observables commute. And a Cauchon-Specker proof of contextuality implies that there is no such possible value assignment. So this is what I mean by contextuality. Contextuality is the impossibility of coming up with such a function, which is a consistent value assignment that obeys quantum correlations. Okay. So this is the theorem that we have, which is kind of, which follows very, very trivially from the results that I showed you before, which is the eigenstates of a set of observables that do not allow a non-contextual value assignment cannot have any ontic overlap. By that, I mean take any subtheory and take your set of observables, and the if those set of observables don't allow a non-contextual value assignment, then the eigenstates of those observables cannot be described by the same state in any given model. Okay, so from this, it's pretty obvious how you can extend this to come up with the kind of result that we did for qubit stabilizer subtheory. You just take the largest set of quantum states that can be simulated by a single ontic state, which is basically the largest set of states that do not allow a proof of contextuality. And this will give you the minimum size of the ontic space because this is what is going to bound the minimum size of the ontic space required to simulate those statistics. Okay, so in summary, what we have done in this what we've tried to do in this upcoming paper is that we've tried to establish a link between contextuality and simulation, particularly in the qubit stabilizer subtheory, where it remained very elusive. And we found that a bound on the size of the state space is something that is linked to the number of observables that can be consistently given a non-contextual value assignment. So we propose this as a measure of contextuality. So the measure that I would like to propose here is, what is the largest set of observables that, or largest set of states that allow a non-contextual value assignment? And your state space is going to be bounded by that measure. And then I would, even though I've kind of hand-waved how this can be extended to other quantum subtheories, we haven't actually formally worked anything outside of qubit stabilizer subtheory. So if anyone has any ideas, please come and talk to me. The main problem being is that in the qubit stabilizer subtheory, it was relatively easy to find the sets, the largest sets of states that allowed a non-contextual value assignment. I don't know whether this is an easy problem for arbitrary subtheories, but if it is, then we have a very nice framework of linking that to a nice simulation result. With that, I'd like to thank you, and you can ask me any question.
Do you have any ideas about approximate simulability if you only want to get the probabilities up to some epsilon? Can you generalize?
Well, so everything that I said was true for possibilistic models. It doesn't actually, the probabilities don't matter.
But what if you don't care if zero is exactly zero?
Yeah, exactly. Okay, so that's the thing. One thing we do assume in this proof is like perfect measurements. And we know that we don't have perfect measurements. So I suspect that when you add noise to measurements, there'll be some, maybe the non-contextual value assignments will have to be replaced by some kind of contextuality inequalities, but we haven't worked that out yet.
So you can get PBR-like effects outside of stabilizer quantum mechanics as well. Do any of your conclusions transfer to that more general setting?
Well, if you can show me like a PBR-like set of states, then yes, it will immediately follow from there. It depends on what you mean by PBR-like, of course.
Something where you don't have this conclusive exclusion of outcomes.
Yeah.
Just curious if you thought about the connection between your that early in the talk and Hardy's proof of the ontological excess baggage theorem.
Mm-hmm.
So in his approach, he basically had an argument that said the quantum space has to be partitioned. There have to be something like an infinite number of different partitions of the space.
Mm-hmm.
And that shows you that there has to be an infinite number of ontic states.
Mm-hmm.
But if we had a finite number of ontic states, I imagine I could figure out some bound on the number of ontic states by saying how many distinct partitions of that set there are.
That's exactly what we've done.
Okay, that wasn't totally obvious.
The way we partitioned the ontic space was by saying that these are the sections of disjoint support. Because if you have a set of states that have to have disjoint support, you need to partition them. And so we partitioned the ontic space by figuring out which states have to have disjoint support. And then what is the minimum number of partitions required, and that gives you your minimum size of the ontic space by just having one ontic state in each partition.
Out of curiosity, was that inspired by the ontological excess theorem, or is it only after the fact that you realized the difference?
Yeah, it was only after the fact, yeah. We never thought of simulation when we were trying to work out this result. Were you thinking of PBR and contextuality? And coming up with a contextual ontological model?
Very naive question. I mean, as a specialist, though. At the beginning of our talk, you seem to say that qubits are somehow more non-classical than qubits.
They're more classical.
And less classical than qubits.
Right? No,
and at the end of the talk,
mm-hmm.
they're effectively more classical, right? Because you have n instead of n squared.
No, I said at the beginning as well, like qubits are more classical than qubits in the sense that they admit like a very efficient simulation, a more efficient simulation than qubit stabilizers.
Right.
Yeah. I said, I think what might have confused you is that I said that injecting magic states gives you, but magic states is outside of the qubit stabilizer subfield.
So, but I understand that this injection makes the two things the same, or are there any, you know, incremental differences in making everything fully quantum?
I'm not an expert on this, but I mean, from my understanding of it, and you guys can correct me if I'm wrong, that when you have qubit or qubit stabilizer subtheory and you inject magic states into either of the subtheories, you get universal quantum computation?
The boundary said it can't be tight, right?
It's not tight.
At all. Because if you put n equals 2 in there, you get one state.
Yes, and also I missed out constant factors.
Okay.
That's why I have the squiggle.
And if you look at the 8-state model, which is, you know, sort of full model of the qubit stabilizer, there's 8 states in the 8-state model. You require 8 states to actually do it.
Yeah, but you can also simulate it for a single qubit. You can also have the Wigner function that has 4 states.
If you have a pair of measure, right?
Huh?
If you have a pair of measure.
Yeah, but I've only considered, the setup that I had at the beginning was only prepare a measure. I don't think about contexture, and I mean, I don't have this, what you said is true if you require transformation non-contextuality, but I'm not insisting on any kind of transformation non-contextuality or anything. So that still holds.
Yeah, you're not looking at constants.
Yes, I'm just looking at reproducing statistics for a data table, and that has nothing to do with transformations.
About efficiencies in the simulation. Do you have rigorous statement about it? Because I'm from a background of complexity. I mean, it's really hard to prove that something is really efficient. We could just haven't found yet an efficient algorithm.
Yeah. So when I talk about efficiency, I'm not saying anything about time. What I'm saying is the efficiency in the number of classical bits, required to encode the state of your system, and as long as that grows polynomially with the number of qubits, which is the system size, I see that as efficient. If it doesn't, if it grows exponentially, then that's inefficient.
I mean, when it grows exponentially, do you mean that it has to go exponentially, or if that could be a way?
Yeah, what I've shown is that the scaling has to be n squared, and you can't do better than n squared. So what I'm trying to answer is that even though n squared is an efficient scaling,
yes,
the reason it cannot be reduced to a linear scaling, which is n, is because of contextuality.
Okay.
So I'm trying to answer why, despite qubit stabilizers having an efficient simulation, you still have contextuality.
There's an additional constraint on simulation, is that the state has to work for any measurement procedure you might make after that, right? Whereas if you just want to use some kind of simulation, you might be able to combine the preparation of measurement together.
So,
okay. So your final result about how the eigenstates of any set of observables that don't allow Cauchy-Specker non-contextual assignment cannot have support between their logic states. That'll also be true for the response functions. Like if I think of it, not of the preparations of those eigenstates, but I think about the response functions associated with those eigenstates. I think I can make the same statement about the overlaps of their supports, just because the perfect correlations between the preparations of an eigenstate and the measurement of an eigenstate means they have to have the same logic support. And I wonder, in that language of response functions, is there maybe a more intuitive way of seeing that that doesn't go via your arguments? I mean, I don't know that there is. I wonder, because it becomes much closer. Like not having a Cauchy-Specker non-contextual assignment feels like, well, that's something about whether their ontic supports of the response functions overlap in a certain way. It feels like maybe there's a more direct path to the result that way. And then you use the perfect correlations to infer it for the preparations.
Yeah,
anyways,
perhaps.
What you said requires preparation on
contextuality. Yeah, to go from the perfect correlations to this mapping between how you model the eigenstates as preparations and as measurements that would require preparation on contextuality.
I mean, I haven't thought about it, but because most of the models that I've thought of before this have been outcome deterministic, but I mean, I'm happy to kind of, if you have better intuition, because right now I don't really have that much intuition about what you're saying, but if you can think of a way of simplifying this proof, then yeah, definitely talk.
Is there any way to challenge to extend, because this is kind of kinematic situation, right? So if you want to imagine dynamics, like algorithms, is it the only way that we have to inject magic states, or maybe just try to simulate dynamics all the time, thinking in that perspective that you have?
No, magic state injection is not the only way of getting universal quantum computation. There are other ways. But I think that was just kind of motivation for why the stabilizer subtheory is an important focus of research. And yeah, so I mean, I'm not an expert in how you can get universal quantum computation via other means, but they definitely exist, so that's not unique. Matt, you've been wanting to ask one for a while.
Well, it's sort of more of a comment, following up the couple of things Rob said. I think I would be willing to bet that this probably has more to do with preparation contextuality than Gaussian contextuality for two reasons. First of all, we know that we can translate Gaussian state groups into preparation contextuality groups. And secondly, in the example of Hardin's ontological excess baggage theorem, it's the states involved in that proof are basically the chained Bell inequality states. And since it's for a single qubit, it can't be derived from a proof of Gaussian state contextuality, but that is a proof of preparation contextuality. So I would imagine that there's some result which is connecting sets of states which prove preparation
I kind of doubt that. The reason being, I've thought about this a little bit, and the reason I doubt that is because the way the proof is structured is that once you get a measurement, after doing the measurement, you get the image of the states that you get includes at least one orthogonal pair. And that only happens because there is no consistent value assignments to all of them. So I can't see how a proof of contextuality that isn't Cauchon-Specker, but kind of outside of Cauchon-Specker, would give you that same kind of proof.
I'm saying ontic excess baggage theorem,
for example. Right, okay. Yeah, perhaps. But yeah, we can talk about that.
If it is true for the response functions, I just thought it through. I can tell you about it later.
Yes, okay.
It's straightforward to see. Thinking about Cauchon-Specker as the marginal problem.
And does it simplify the proofs?
Well, the real question is, how do you go from this fact about the response functions to the corresponding fact about preparations? And I think you can do that without positing preparation on contextuality, because your proof didn't require it. But yeah, I haven't thought that through yet. So.
Okay.
Any more questions?